Radio Film.
Hi. Okay, I'd like to introduce our speakers tonight. We have Patty and Ken. We're going to have Ken's going to go up first and hand it over to them. Thank you very much.
My name is Ken, and I know I don't look like one, but I'm an alcoholic. And I am just delighted to be here tonight with all of you. First, because I'm in a recovery program. Second, because I'm still vertical and breathing on my own with a fatal mental disease that kills most people that have it. And I'm just delighted about that I'm still alive today. And thanks to you and other programs, I have a really good life. I want to thank James Paul for inviting us to come here and speak tonight. We're going to split. I'm the AA and she's the Al-Anon. I'm also a grateful member of the Al-Anon family groups, but tonight I got my AA hat on. I also want to thank Matt and Johnny for showing me this meeting, the Men's Stag, some time ago, and it's a wonderful group, and I'm just delighted to be here. So I'm going to talk about my view as an alcoholic. I have a disease, it turns out, that lives in my mind. It seems to have, this is just my own take on what's wrong with me. I don't know how I got sick, but I have a disease that lives in my mind that's just very thirsty. And it just wants the next drink, but it can't get itself to the liquor store by itself. It needs me. And it's got to convince me that it's a good idea to go to the liquor store and get something. And it's constantly watching. It's paying attention to what I'm saying right now. And it's saying, oh, he knows about that, huh? Okay. So it's going to look for any emotion that's either unusually high or unusually low. That's an opportunity to take over and put thoughts in my head that I will most likely accept, which I wouldn't if I were on a nice level emotional plane. And it knows how my mind works extremely well, better than I do, because it lives in there and it just watches and sees things. And it's very patient. It's also a master of disguise and camouflage, and it doesn't let me see it. And all of a sudden, there will be a thought in my mind. It's my thought, so it must be good, right? But I didn't put it there. Wait a minute. You know, I said I was never going to drink again. What am I doing driving to the drinking? And it's critically important that I run that past you, or a sponsor, or somebody else that is not influenced by my disease. And they can see it. But I can't see it. So fortunately, I'm still alive, and I'm very grateful for that. We met in about 1964 in a city college in Santa Monica, and we got married in 1967 after both of us graduated with bachelor's degrees from different schools. I went back to school to get a doctorate, and she went to work as a social worker and earned enough money over those 4 years to buy us a brand new car and the down payment on a new house for us I got a job here in Los Angeles after that time. And so we proceeded to do what the American dream calls for. We had kids, two boys, we bought a house, we had two cars. We had a dog and two cats and a vegetable garden in the backyard. No picket fence, but pretty close. And things were good. And for that 10 years, until I was about 30, I was a normal drinker. There's no history of alcoholism in my family. So there's no genetic basis for my disease. As they say in my group, I broke my drinker. But it happened very slowly, and alcohol started to become a little more important now and then. And eventually it got to be pretty important. And when I was about, 36, 35, 36, we got to go overseas for a year with the kids. It's called a sabbatical leave. You get to go study someplace else. We went to Australia, which is not the best place in the world to try to quit drinking. And that's where, in retrospect, that's where I became alcoholic. That's where I lost the ability to control my drinking. In our big book, this thing, this is the book that she bought me. I'll get to that in a minute. Anyway, so we're in Australia, and I'm drinking more, and lost the ability to control my drinking. Our book says there's two symptoms for alcoholism. On page 21, where it talks about a real alcoholic, and this is what my button says, real alcoholic, I'm a real alcoholic. I need to hear that by myself daily. I need to know that I'm a real alcoholic, because overnight, it fades away. And I become normal somehow. That's this thing that's working in here. I don't need to go to those meetings anymore. Thank you, AA. I learned everything you have taught me. I know how to do this. I'm on my own now. Bye. And I see people do that, and then we're going to their funeral. It's a very sneaky disease, and it scares the heck out of me. So it says on page 21 that one of the symptoms of alcoholism is once you're drinking, you can't stop when you want to. And the second symptom, which is on page 24 in italics, so we'll ignore it, of course, it says that we are without defense against the first drink. And that means to me that when I'm stone cold sober, I will drink again. I have to. That's what the disease makes me do. So when I was drinking back then, alcohol became very toxic and poisonous to me. I'm a physiologist. I can explain some of the details about that. But medical science just doesn't know exactly what happens to us still. And our book says science may one day accomplish this, that is, allow an alcoholic to drink normally. It still hasn't happened. I follow the literature, and it just isn't there yet. Doesn't look like it's going to get there in any. So if you're alcoholic, forget the idea that someday, somehow, you will be able to enjoy and control your drinking. That isn't happening yet. So I had both of those symptoms when I came back, but I wasn't able to see it because my disease didn't let me put two and two together. I went to the biomedical libraries in Australia to try to look up alcoholism because I could see something was wrong. And there's a pitiful amount of information there. And that's pretty much still the case. It's very sad. What happened was my drinking got a lot worse immediately after we got back. On August 4th, she went to Al-Anon. And on August 5th, my life changed a lot. This book appeared on my drinking chair, open to the page that she thought would be the page that would solve my problem. It didn't. Within a couple of weeks, and the pressure that came with that, I agreed to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay. I'll go, but I'd read this book that she put. I'm a quick study, and there's a whole bunch of objections to what's in this book, especially those steps. I mean, there's virtually no connection, logical connection, between what you do in these steps and staying sober. The first step talks about sobriety and drinking, but the rest of them don't. It's like, I need to know, before I'm going to work these steps, I need to know why I'm supposed to work them. What do they do? What do they change in me? What's the mechanism of this thing? And I talked to these guys. I went to, I promised her I would go to a week's worth of AA meetings, and there's a place near our house, and I went there and complained. And got people up against the wall and they couldn't answer me. And I said, I know, because it's just the whole program is silly. And eventually somebody said, you know, there's a meeting in Beverly Hills. It's called the Roxbury Men's Stag, which is now my home group and became my home group back then. And I went there expecting to see the president of AA, because it's Beverly Hills, you know. And I was going to get him up against the wall and get a written, after I explained my situation, I was going to get a written note to take to her so I didn't have to go to these damn meetings anymore. And that didn't happen. But I did find a reason to walk out of there. And I went to coffee with some of the guys, and they said, you know, in chapter 3, right at the beginning, it says, we don't like to pronounce anybody alcoholic, but you can figure it out for yourself really easily. Just go to a local bar and try some controlled drinking. And then they gave me the situation. They said, 2 drinks a day, no more, no less. I said, thank you. I'm going home, told my wife. AA told me I can drink. So I'm a scientist, so I did the experiment. And I tried, you know, this was Thursday. And I had 1 drink. Now, by then, I was drinking lab alcohol, 190 proof, at school in my lab. And so I made a highball out of the Coke machine and mixed it up and drank it. And then I went home where there was no alcohol, thanks to Al-Anon. And I waited to get drunk or lose control or whatever they said was going to happen with the first drink. It's the first drink that gets you. That's what they say again and again, and it didn't happen. So the next day was Friday, and I'm working, and, you know, 5 o'clock rolls around. It's just time to go home, and hey, it's okay. You know, I can have another. Oh, no, you're a scientist. You better repeat your experiment. So I did that, and I didn't get drunk again. Well, Saturday's the day I mow the lawn with a six-pack of beer, and I did that, and so I made it 2 days on the experiment, and then that third day really got me, and I got really badly drunk on beer first and then wine. Red Mountain, Burgundy, $1.49 a gallon back then. And ended up eventually in 12 days drunk, could not. All those bad things that I heard in AA meetings happened to me during those 12 days. You know, the delirium tremens, the seizures, almost seizures, the DTs, the hallucinations were horrible, and on and on. Anyway, I ended up, she came into the bedroom with an ultimatum, and I beat her to it. I said, I give up. I've been beaten. I need help. Get me to a hospital. And I'm here today, still alive. And I know what alcoholism can do. It can kill me. So I went back, crawling back to that AA meeting, begging for help. They said, all we got is the 12 steps. You said you didn't like them. Okay. And I said, well, let's try that, you know. And they said, yeah, you're a scientist. You're supposed to be open-minded. Try things. Do experiments with it. So I did an experiment with the 12 steps to prove they would not work in my case. And I'm here sober today to tell you about it. They worked. They worked spectacularly. But I couldn't understand how they worked. And they said, look, Ken, there's lots of recipes around. This is a recipe to connect you with God. That's what comes out the other end of the 12 steps. That's the only purpose of these 12 steps, is to give you a higher power that will solve your problem, page 45. Okay, I'll try it. And that's what happened to me. I got a higher power long before I got to step 12. Other people in the meeting saw it, and they were patting me on the back, saying, hey, Ken, you're doing great. I said, well, I wanted to argue with them. No. So what's happened since then is I've slowly been able to incorporate these steps into my life. And today, let's see, that was so, she went to Al-Anon on August 4th, and I got sober on August 28th. So that was less than a month. Al-Anon saved my life. She saved my life by going to Al-Anon. And there's been a whole series of people and fellowships and steps and books that have saved my life on a daily basis since then. It's just a wondrous thing, and I still don't understand it, but I don't need to understand it anymore. it's a fabulous event that has happened to me. And the best part is that these steps have become internalized. They've lost their numbers. I don't think, oh, I'm doing step two right now. What I say to myself in the morning is, I am powerless over alcohol, and my life is unmanageable by me right now. This disease is working overtime right now. I know that a power greater than myself is restoring me to sanity. Present tense, personal. I turn my will and my life over to that power, praying only for knowledge of its will for me and the power to carry that out. Step 11. I only pray for knowledge of its will, not that she gets a nice dress or anything like that, nothing specific. It says in the book that we, you know, if we do that, we have to say, if it be thy will. So my life has become just incredibly amazing because my ego and insistence in running my own life has just gotten way low, and something else has filled in that void big time. I just want to share, well, I got a couple things if I got time. Let's see, let's try one. I had a lot of trouble with step three. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understand God. I'm a scientist. A big part of my job is creativity, originality, the ability to foresee questions that will be important in the future and then be the first to write a research proposal to the federal government for funding. And if I can't use my own mind, then I'm going to lose the job because they want you to bring money in to support the university. So that's how it works. So I can't do step three. And after a couple of years of going to meetings, my home group's the Beverly Hills Men's Stag in Roxbury Park on a Wednesday night. And my sponsor's there, Dave, and a whole bunch of guys that we just, it's like the Men's Stag here. Somebody looked at me one day and they said, Kim, what's wrong? I said, nothing, I'm fine. come on. And then they got me up against the wall and say, what's going on? You know, what's it? Well, the secretary's a little this and this and this. And then I said, well, and then some graduate students are giving me little problems and some of the faculty are not appreciating the stuff I do. And after a little more of that, they said, Ken, you have got to give up. You have to turn over your career. Now, I heard change your career. So they said, if you don't, you're going to drink. And if you drink, we know your history, you're going to die. Probably within a couple of weeks. That's what happened to you last time, except for medical intervention. And I said, okay, yeah, I don't want to die. I don't want to drink. So I went home. The next morning, I got up, but I didn't. I just sat on the edge of the bed and said, okay, God, whatever you are, what do I do next? Nothing happened. So I sat there, kept asking, and after about 20 minutes, something said, go to the toilet. And then it said, brush your teeth. And then it said, get some breakfast after you get dressed. And then it said, go to work. I said, what? Go to work. Are you sure? Go to work. And I went to work. And I sat down. And I started doing what was in front of me because that's what my sponsor said to do. Rather than reshuffling and reprioritizing everything and putting it in different stacks, I just had it all in one stack. I started doing what I was supposed to was in front of me. And after a few days or weeks of this, people started coming in and saying, hey, you know, something's happened to you. It's cool. Hey, you know, this might be a good time to talk to you again about that collaborative project we were talking about. And this other guy comes and says, you know, I got this really promising graduate student. He'd probably like to work in your lab if you'd be. See, now I was running my own show because that's what we do at the university, little fiefdoms and kingdoms and stuff like it, keep secrets and all that stuff. But this program said, no, we do this together. We share, We support each other. We're of service. And I started doing that without really thinking about it. And in the next 5 years, my career exploded. I got invited all over the world to do research projects and give lectures, and my publication rate tripled. What? How did that happen? It's like I'm sitting on the sidelines watching my team, quarterbacked by this thing called higher power, win every game. It was amazing, just incredible. And it's still going on. I just need to get out of the way. This is an incredibly strong program for changing lives for the better. And overall, I think for helping society heal from some of the things that some of these chemicals are doing to it. I am so grateful to be here and so grateful to be alive, and thank you very much for being here.
I'm Patty.
Patty.
Can the back hear me?
Yes.
We are good. All righty. You heard some of what it was like from the alcoholic standpoint. I'd like to tell you the Al-Anon viewpoint. I was not raised in an alcoholic home. I knew about, from that job that Ken mentioned, I knew about the disease of alcoholism in the sense that I knew it existed. My job was to help people. I was very good at it. I know exactly what you should do, and I'm willing to tell you. And that was my job. So I did that. The reality is, all I knew was that when I sentenced people to go to AA, Al-Anon, and Alateen, I'm willing to bet none of them did it. Because I was telling them what to do. At least that's what I've learned here in Al-Anon. I think the main thing that I've gotten from Al-Anon is an ability to ask for help, because before I could do it all myself, thank you very much, because he was not helping me. Therefore, it was all on me. The Al-Anon salute. Among other things that we have. The reality is, when we moved to LA and began that phase of our career, if you will, we were pretty good. It got worse, as it always does, when drinkers are broken or you have the disease. I knew intellectually there was a disease out there. I did not know it internally. I didn't understand it. I didn't know what was wrong with him, and I spent all my time trying to keep track of him, which is kind of hard to do when you're in an airport flying off to another country. You have 12 pieces of luggage, two kids to try and keep track of when they're little, and I'm thinking to myself, it'll be different. So I term that a planned geographic, which for anyone new simply means you're going to go somewhere else and it'll be better. The problem is, of course, when you go somewhere else, not only do you take them with you, you take me with you too. And that means that I went with me, and I'm getting weird. It is a family disease, and I'm here to attest to that. I changed, and part of the reason I changed was I was told exactly what was wrong with me. I did not see what I saw, I did not smell what I smelled, and I did not hear what I heard. I got extremely good at telling the difference between a Mickey's pull tab and a Coors Pop Top at 50 paces around corners. I developed those keen Al-Anon senses. I heard well. I watched the levels change in various bottles and things. And then I kept wondering, gee, did I drink that much? You know, because it's my fault. didn't have dinner on time, whatever. It was always my fault. So the reality is, I also had, besides the keen sense of hearing, I had the keen sense of smell. Hi, dear. You, welcome home. Where is that smell coming from? There's no liquor on campus, I knew that. But where is it coming from? How's it getting it? I did not know that alcoholics are cunning, baffling, and powerful. And they're slippery. Now, part of what he didn't tell you was that during this time when he was, when I was taking him places, I'll put it nicely, I would make appointments for him to get him better, because I'm a helper. That's what my job told me to do. I made an appointment with the National Council on Alcoholism. I took him there. He was a little running late because, of course, he had to get his liquid courage to come in the car with me to go there. And I'm disturbed at him for being late. We had a VW Bug at the time. I don't know if you know what those are, but they used to have a stick shift in the middle, very long, tall stick shift. He's driving. I'm leaning out the window, walking slowly, because he's driving very carefully, down the street, trying to reach over him to get the emergency brake to stop the car so that I could then move him into the passenger seat. And I did it up and over the stick shift without damaging anything, fortunately. And yes, gentlemen, you know what we're talking about. And then I drove him off, and that's where I bought the big book. They don't take people in that program, or didn't at that time, unless they'd been sober for 24 hours. He'd been sober about 24 minutes between our house and there. So they didn't take him. And I was a little disturbed about that, because I thought they ought to. Where else would you go? I took him to the doctor, to an outpatient with our medical insurance. The reality is, we would stop for a little liquid refreshment on the way there. He would spend all day there. They'd talk to me about Al-Anon. And I'd nod my head and said, oh yes, I've heard about that, yeah, sure. And then ignore the rest of what they were talking about and not go. Then we'd drive back and stop for a little liquid refreshment. And that's kind of how it went until that last time when he drank around the clock. During that time, I had begun to go to Al-Anon meetings, and this was in 1980. And what they told me in my first meeting was a couple things. They said, keep coming back. And they also said, it will get better. And I did not understand that they were telling me the truth, because I could not see how this could get any better, because it's already awful and terrible, and there was no, I could not fathom any idea of it getting better. But they kept telling me that every time I went. That's all the meetings I went to would say that. I went to a lot. I picked the ones with childcare because I knew, had sense enough, and this to me is my God working in my life, my higher power. I had sense enough not to leave the kids at home alone with him. Because at that time he was smoking and he was drinking around the clock, and we had a lot of burn holes in various portions of various things. And every time I left, I just knew the house would burn down while I was gone. Part of me didn't care. Part of me said, oh well. However, when I got back, just to show you that I was not completely 100% okay, I would put the boys off somewhere else, get them doing something, and I would tiptoe down the hallway to the bedroom, quietly as I could, open the door about that wide, and peek one eye in to see if it was still breathing. The chest was rising and falling. And I knew if it wasn't, I would call 911. I might wait a while just to make sure. I was thinking that, I really was. And if it was going up and down, then I knew he was still alive and I didn't have to do anything more. And that was my life. Pretty poor life, quality of life. So after a little while in Al-Anon, they told me I had to do some footwork. And they said, if he ever asked for help, what would you do? And I said, well, you know, he's never gonna ask. He's gonna die. I'd accepted the fact that he was going to die. The reality is, obviously, he didn't. But they gave me some books to look at, some programs to look at. They suggested some things to check into. What could we afford? What could we do? Where could you go? So I called people in hospitals and halfway houses and things like that. And I had an idea what I would offer him should he ever ask for help. So when he did actually ask for help, I could not believe it. I said, okay. And I started walking down the hallway and the phone rang. And this was quite early one morning. It was another Al-Anon. I got a lot of these calls out of the blue, simply because I showed up at meetings and told a few people what was going on. They would call me and say, what's going on? And I burst into tears and I said, he asked for help. And I don't know what to do. And this lady had been working with me quite a lot. She said, didn't you do some footwork? Duh. I said, yes. She said, okay, what is it? She made me go through it all with her. I talked to her for quite some time. And she reminded me that I had a plan. So I went back, I offered him a plan. He chose a plan. We went, and sort of the rest is history, if you will. He was able eventually to get sober and stay sober, and I've been in Al-Anon ever since. And I'm probably not going to leave. What I found in Al-Anon is the ability to have choices today. I can choose anything. In one of our little readings, it says, just for today, I will be happy as I make up my mind to be. And that leads me to the phrase, which I hate the worst in Al-Anon, which is happiness is an inside job. It's not my job, it's his job, as far as I'm concerned, or their job, whoever. The reality is, it is my job to make me happy. I need to do that for myself. I had lost self in the disease of alcoholism because it was all about him. When I got here to Al-Anon, I was afflicted with the yabbits. Yabbit, you don't understand. Yabbit, I'm different. Yabbit, he. I also was afflicted with the he. You'd ask me how I was. I said, well, he. How are you doing today? Well, he. How are you feeling today? Well, he. So I had to learn a new way of talking and a new way of thinking, something that did not involve the other person in my life, but involved me, which I did. In working with the sponsor, I started my steps. I got through step 3. And at the time, we did not have some of the books we have today. We only had a 12 and 12 at that time, which is a green and white book. And it doesn't have much in the way of guidance. I mean, I did work with the sponsor. She gave me a lot of guidance and a lot of ideas. But today, I work primarily out of the Paths to Recovery. It has questions in the back of each chapter for each step, each tradition, and each concept of service in Al-Anon. It's one of the best books, I think, that we have. It came out a number of years later. I've worked through it. The people I work with go through it as well most of the time. We also have a new book that we're working in. Some of the people I'm working with, they like it. It's the Spiral Brown, Green, and White book called Reaching for Personal Freedom, something like that. Yeah, pardon? Yeah, that's it, Reaching for Personal Freedom. And it's got not as many questions, but they're still very thoughtful and insightful questions, and it's got some really good writings in it. And those are the books that I like working out of today in terms of steps and tradition work. And I try and have the people that I work with use some of those. Doesn't matter to me how they work their steps, just as long as they do it. I ended up having to change sponsors because mine left town. I haven't quite decided whether that's a reflection on me or... I tried hard not to take it personally the first time I knew she was leaving. But I did find another one eventually. I don't recommend going without one. I think it's really good to have one because they're the people that you can call at any time. I also have sort of a cadre of Al-Anon friends that, again, they're the people that I can call at any time. I was given the ability to pick up that 500-pound phone and make a phone call to total strangers and say, I need help. I have sat on people's doorstep and said, I need help. That was in the early days. And of course, I always apologize for needing help because I'm a good Al-Anon. Today, I don't do that. Today, I just say, hey, you know, I need help. This is a situation. Got any suggestions for me? And that's the really nice thing. I want to talk a little bit about some God shots that have happened. Not only have they happened to us two together, but they've also happened with our kids. Now, our kids were brought up in Alatot and Alateen. And they stopped going to Alateen about the time when I knew they really needed it. But they got bigger than I am. And when they're looking down at you, it's kind of hard to say, yes, you really ought to go. You ought to go. But anyway, they have a basic knowledge of the program and they know where help is. I raised those kids in this program, and I would go to other parents and I would say, had you let them go to concerts? I know what goes on at concerts, you know. And I don't want them going. And we had a discussion, and they ended up going to concerts. Guess what? They didn't die. They didn't OD at the time. Today, the kids, one chooses to drink and one chooses not to. I am a little concerned about the one that chooses to drink sometimes. I don't think he's handles it well, in my opinion. And that's all I get to have is an opinion. You know, the nice thing is I don't have to watch it most of the time. So I don't know. You know, right now he's supporting himself, his dog, his car, and his house. That's pretty darn good. The other one who chooses not to drink is supporting himself, more or less, and is not really doing his life my way. But when they get older than you are, you know, I'm 39. They're 46 and 41. You gotta let them go, you know, at some point in time. And it was only through the grace of Al-Anon and my higher power that I was able to let him go. Our younger son had a serious accident. And I had my mother with me. She was in a wheelchair. And this is a gift of sobriety. Within an hour after getting the call, he'd been in a serious snowboard accident up at Mammoth. And he was being life-flighted out to Reno. I had a flight. I had someone to come in and watch Mom. Ken took me to the airport. I had a motel, I had a car, a bag packed, and I was on my way. Guess what? That boy today is doing just fine. I walked into the motel, and I told them that I was there because I had someone in the hospital, and they said, oh, we give you a 5% discount. Okay. I went to the hospital, it was late at night, and I'm sitting in there watching the boy breathe with all the lines and all the hoorah that goes on in hospitals. And I said, you know, I really need to find an Al-Anon meeting while I'm here. A nurse came in, and I know nurses know some of these things, and so do doctors, but a nurse came in and said, you know, I'm a member of Al-Anon, and do you know of any meetings around here or how to get a hold of Al-Anon? She said, well, I'm a member. And if you go down this road and turn left, 5 minutes away, you're going to find an Olano club that has an Al-Anon meeting every day at noon. So guess where I was every day at noon while I was there for 9 days. But I got revenge on that kid. You know, when you go to truly, you laugh. The reality is, when you go to the emergency room, they cut your clothes off. So he's buck naked in his hospital gown, and I have to take him home. I went to Kmart or someplace like that, and I got him the most awful clothes I could find. I knew he'd wear them once and probably throw them away. But how many Bugs Bunny ears can you have on your boxers or hearts? Or, you know, I could have outfitted him for weeks, but I had to choose one of the most awful kind. So I did that, and the t-shirt was all in the same line, and I was debating between hot pink sweats. You know, this poor kid had to put up with me. I ended up getting gray for lack of, you know, I chose better than that, but the reality is, he's doing just fine. You know, the nice thing is, and I know that Reno has a great deal of really good meetings. As I said, I went to one every day there. That's really nice. And the rest of our life, you know, we celebrated 50 years of marriage last year. Thank you. The only reason we're still together, and I haven't killed him or got in a car crash myself, is because of the program of Al-Anon and AA. Because that has put our marriage back together. We've used the program on our marriage. We go to a married couples group that has AA Al-Anon affiliations, in the sense that all of us are members of a program, and we work our marriage with the steps and traditions. Because without that, we probably couldn't have stayed married. So it's a lot of hard work. It is something that is extremely rewarding. And if you live long enough, you get to celebrate great anniversaries. You know, not a bad deal. Thanks very much. Thanks, John Paul, for asking.
Speakers, Patty and Ken again.
Yeah.